Hey guys, this is Lauren Balsara. Welcome back to The Human Entrepreneur. We again have Isabella, but this time talking about her entrepreneur journey, which is fascinating. Hi Isabella, thank you for joining us once again.
Yep, so I'm back. Apparently I can't stay away.
We've talked all about the technical aspects, but let's talk more about you because you have a very fascinating journey. So what is your story?
So my story, I guess starting from the beginning, I did my IB and then I studied law at LSE, which is a very corporate university. And I think a long story short is I really thought I would be a lawyer and I didn't believe in the startup community. I didn't think you could learn much or if there was any money in it. And essentially in third year, I had this realization that one, I'm probably not going to get a job in law for one reason or another. But more importantly, I was like, I don't want to get a job in law. So I had this question of what the hell do I do with my life? And so I went a bit crazy and I was doing stuff for a hedge fund and I was doing stuff for LexisNexis, which is a legal tech platform. And then I was doing very randomly something with this program called Kickstart. Now Kickstart, for anybody that's a student, is a fantastic incubator program based in London that runs for about 6 months. You get great speakers in every week from Starling Bank, Monzo, Seed Legals, really kind of the top innovators and disruptors within the London ecosystem. Anyway, so I applied as a joke and funnily enough got accepted and basically somehow fell into creating a company. And I think that 6 months taught me so much more or much more valuable things than my degree ever did, because it was a journey and we didn't necessarily succeed, right? But the whole point of being a founder is the biggest benefit is what you learn through your failure. And that's a really cliche, but so what do I mean? So what did we do?
This is how Stepforce was created.
So Stepforce was basically created at the height of the refugee crisis. So there was a lot of Syrians who are very educated people, doctors, nurses, jewelers, engineers coming in, and they would finally get granted refugee status. But when you're granted refugee status, you have about, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to find a job before you're not given your benefits, right? Before you become homeless. And then you've got this whole issue of the job department that's meant to be giving them employment being pretty terrible and not really helping them find work and not having a centralized system for them to find not just work but work that suits their top talent. And then the other issue is all the refugee centers don't work as a conglomerate, right? So you've got loads of little initiatives but they don't really make a difference because they're not working on a wider scale. So me and my three co-founders, who I met very randomly and who are now very good friends to this day, were basically like, how do we solve this? So we created Stepforce, right? Allowing those refugees to take the next step to not just gain employment but gain skilled employment in a profession that they need. So what was the business? Well, the business is this: diversity inclusion is a top part of any corporate motto nowadays, right? The more diverse of the opinions you have, the better the results. In medicine, that applies. Somebody who was trained in Syria has a very different approach to curing things as a doctor trained through the NHS system like every other doctor. Same with an engineer, same with anybody else in a corporate. So we thought, okay, the way that we pitch this is basically creating this hiring platform where to have access to this top talent that is vetted by us and vetted by a process, basically companies or the NHS or the government would have to pay a subscription fee to us, right, to have access to this pool of employees. And then once they get hired, we would get a commission fee on that hire. And basically a big question was like, should all of that money have gone back into the business? Mm-hmm. And that's what we wanted. Yeah. And should we take the social enterprise route, which we did. Now, did the business succeed? No. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I think one was we were all university students. Two is that it's incredibly hard to get anything in terms of having access to the database of who and what refugees are in the country and what do they do and where are they, because the government doesn't give you that unless you know somebody, and refugee centers wouldn't give you that because they were scared of the liability. So we had this incredible idea but we didn't have the practical ability or knowledge to implement it. So we hit a roadblock there. So we started just going around refugee centers, individually talking to them, getting their data, running case studies, and trying to make individual contacts to random people we would meet. But unfortunately, one of our co-founders moved back to Malaysia, and another one is still studying medicine, and another one is back at his final year of uni. And I think it's a thing of like, this is not a half-assed job. This is something you need to commit to. So we kind of put it on hold. However, in that process, you know, it didn't stop there. I was getting, as I was going through my startup career with Seed Legals, I was meeting a lot of founders of refugee type companies like ours, and I was actually putting them in contact because I realized how important having that community is. We got invited to 10 Downing Street for our initial efforts for a discussion about the refugee crisis and how to help that. One of the other co-founders gave a TED talk about it, and we won a prize about it. So it was crazy. Like, I guess the idea itself never picked up, but the traction was there, and the demand was there, and now we're just waiting on whether we'll be listed on the Forbes under 30 kind of people for I guess the idea and the thing itself, and I guess, you know, down the line, would I like to pick it up again? Sure.
Nice.
So I don't know, I should say the idea wasn't a success, but you know, learning how to deal with that, creating your own website, going and speaking to people, customer acquisition, traction, like they're all things that I learned as a fluke. So your first startup generally is not going to be your success story, but it will be a huge contributing factor to the one that will become your success story.
So here you are, a social entrepreneur at LSE, accidentally stumbling on the whole idea of entrepreneurship. And then you said that there were a lot of failures, but what are the main things that you actually learned from this entire journey? I mean, you've spoken about customer acquisition. Can you pick a few things and maybe talk about in detail? And what would you do differently?
Yeah, so I mean, that was a lot learned. I think a big thing learned is it doesn't matter how good your idea is, the hardest part is actually users. So you would think, you know, refugees who have no job would be dying to work with you, and they're just not. And I think it's the best way to go about that, and really like committing days and days of just trolling around London, taking up details, is actually a huge commitment, because you know, you get to the end of the week and you're like, God, I want to go to the pub, or like, I just want to go to bed. And actually you have to spend that time doing something that technically doesn't add to your job and doesn't add to your degree and doesn't add you to your friends. So I think a big thing is customer acquisition is really hard. Like, we met the woman who was one of the initial founders, as in creators of Uber. And how did she get Uber drivers in Italy? She would go on her moped and stop next to taxi drivers as they were stopped and tell them to sign up to this app. Like, Uber is now the largest car sharing service in the world, and they couldn't get drivers to begin with. And then once you do have drivers, or once you do have refugees, then that goes. So literally, your hardest bit will be customer acquisition. I guess part two is 100% having a diverse team. It's just, I can't emphasize how important that is. Like, if you have four people who are good at talking to other people, great. Who the hell is going to design the website?
True.
Who's going to develop the product? Nobody. So don't do that whole thing of similars attract. Like, be driven by the idea, but make sure you have a developer. Make sure you have someone for sales. Make sure you have someone for content. Like, all of these different roles, like, you can't do it all. You know, it's a very different thing of like pitching the product to the person. Like, what is the product? Like, let's say for example, Nike trackies, right?
Yep.
Nike trackies versus normal trackies, functionality is the same. That's the development of the product. That's your designer, right? Who's the guy that allows you to go and sell the Nike trackies for 5x what it's worth? The guy who invented the tick, the guy who communicated why it's better, why your product is better to other people. If you look at like Uber, Lyft, they all have the same product. It's ride sharing. Now the question is, who communicates better, who builds? Yeah. And so I think separating those two things is really, really important. We definitely learned that you can't necessarily do both. And I don't think one person should be doing both, because you need to approach very different mindsets. The product is rational. How does it work? Is it a good product? The communication is a lot of bullshit, basically. So yeah, I think those are the two things. And I think, like, don't ever not do it because you can't 100% commit to it. I would say still do it because you'll learn stuff.
Yeah.
But also just don't kid yourself as to how much you can actually get done.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. And how would you do all of this differently if you had the chance? Going back to LSE days, you're studying, you're being a student entrepreneur, what would you do differently?
I think we should have networked a lot more. I think we didn't realize how powerful London was. You literally go on to anything, any event page, you know, Eventbrite, Ticket Arena, whatever, and you can type in demo day, like refugees, like startups, and you will be driven to similar minded people. We took a very like, let's just send loads of emails and then we'll go in person, and that just doesn't work. Like, you really need to just bite the bullet, get up in the morning, go and speak to those people. So I think that was, I think another thing we would have changed is I think we were very undisciplined for a long time, and actually we ended up getting most of what we achieved done in about 3 weeks. We had been on the program for 6 months.
Wow.
It obviously takes time to develop what your idea is, but in terms of actually developing on top of that idea and developing something that matters and gaining traction, that's something you just need to set time. And I think an easy way to set time is when you do it with a co-founder, or like when you do it as a group. If you do something on your own, you're more likely to be like, I really can't be asked. Whereas if you all agree to meet up and just do it, you'll do it.
And any top tips on finding a co-founder?
Yeah, I think it happens quite seamlessly. I think the base of it should be a passion for the idea, but you also don't want to be the same person. Mm. Some of the best companies, the co-founders are great friends, but prior to that, they were just business partners that were incredibly different. And the reason that's important is because you need that diversity of approaches. It basically allows you to understand your customers better, because you just think, oh, I've created this amazing thing. It's so cool. And you ask your mom, and your mom's like, yeah, it's really cool, I'm so proud of you. And then you take it to someone, and they're like, okay, yeah, it's cool, but I don't need it. Like, I'm never going to use this in my life. And it's that thing of, like, you know, knowing that and having people to talk to about that. And then how do you find them? Well, literally through stuff like Kickstart, through any of your university's entrepreneur hubs, through accelerators that your university might be doing, or through, as I said, just coming to London and going onto Eventbrite to all the free events with loads of booze and food that are sponsored that you don't have to pay for, and that you can have a good time and meet really cool, interesting people.
Nice. You brought up this thing about diversity and inclusion, and I've been hearing a lot about it, but I don't know much about it.
Mm.
Well, can you give me a little bit of insight into that?
So diversity and inclusion is this concept that everybody thought to build the next tech company, you just had to be MIT developers.
Mm.
And that's not true, because as many, many people have seen, you could build an incredible product, you know, top tech, super complicated. But if your thing is the tech and you don't actually know how to make other people understand what you've created, then they're never going to understand. And as useful as it might be, you could be, I've got this really cool thing. And someone's like, yeah, but so what? And I think diversity and inclusion is that thing of separating those roles. Like, just because you created something doesn't mean that entitles you to everything. Like,
yeah.
No, you need someone who can communicate what you've created, right? The public person. You need someone who can set goals, right? Okay, you guys keep creating. What happens if you start creating something that people don't want? So who's testing your market? Like, who's making sure that what you are creating is actually useful? And then, you know, and so on and so forth, that keeps on going with as a business grows. Like, I met a founder recently, and he's like, you know, it killed me. Like, I wasn't paying myself a salary. I was on nothing, and I was paying our head of marketing, you know, about £70,000 a year. And he was like, why? Because I needed it, because it was crucial to the business. Yeah, sure, I could have hired someone post-grad, whatever, for £20,000, but it would have been pointless. So just because he didn't know how to do what that person did, and he couldn't do it himself. And I think diversity is inclusion is not like, oh, developers are really cool, so we're only gonna have developers. It's acknowledging that what you do is good, but other people have skills that you need. And you need to make sure that when you're creating your team, you're not just creating people like you, because you'll just develop something that you'll all validate amongst yourselves that actually nobody wants. So having that diversity, not just in practical roles, but also in thought process, is incredibly important.
Okay, so moving on to your story. So you're like, you kickstart, you build this thing called Step Force. You're on your year two, year three?
I was in my third year.
Third year, so final year, LSE.
Mm-hmm.
And then you decided that the law, the degree you're studying, and you don't want to become a lawyer. What changed? What happened? And now you're here at Seed League. Is how did this all happen?
Yeah, so essentially, you know, you go to places like Warwick or LSE or Imperial, and there's very much, basically, until university, it was pretty clear what you had to do, right? Like, you had to go to primary, you had to get good GCSEs, and then you had to go to high school, and then you had to get good A-levels or IB, and then you had to go to a good university. There wasn't that much choice, to be honest. Yeah. And then you go to university, and you're like, yeah, so what do you want to do for the next, like, 2 years? And it's the first time you actually have to make a decision, and nobody actually prepares you for that. And I think universities do a really bad job of actually explaining to you what different jobs are like. Like, academia is very different to the practical reality of work. Like, studying law, to be honest, does not help practicing it. And so, you know, you stick to what you know, which is herd mentality. So depending on what uni you go to, it's very different. At LSE, it was a very corporate. It's like you either go to consulting, investment banking, or law. But then you might go to one of the art schools, and all of them, you know, have to become these edgy artists and dress. And some of them, you know, you could study art and not want to be an artist. Yeah. Like, it's a very different sphere of being a commercial artist. And so it applies anywhere. And so I followed that herd mentality for about 2 years. I interned with Clifford Chance. I worked briefly for a startup. I didn't think it was very interesting. I thought it was beneath me. I was very corporate. And then I wasn't getting any... I didn't get the training contract with Clifford Chance. And I'm really glad I didn't, because I would have taken it. And now seeing what law is actually like, I realized that it just doesn't suit my character at all. So that happened. And then in year three, I just kept going to lectures and realizing I didn't like anybody I studied with. Which I think said a lot, because those are the people I'd be working with. And it kind of hit me. I was like, well, geez. And also then it hit me that, like, you know, in 2004, Uber didn't exist. Monzo didn't exist. Just Eat did not exist. And these are some of the top performing companies, aka, like, there are jobs that I could do that haven't been created yet. So there's not one job to take, and there's not one pathway. And it's ridiculous to say, well, if you don't go to get training from a consultancy, you're not going to do well. Like, it's ridiculous. And so I was like, well, crap, like, I need to open my horizons. And so I started doing everything. Bear in mind, I burnt out. Like, I was doing my law degree. I was working in the LSE gym. I was working on Thursdays after a Wednesday night out for a financial thing. I was working for LexisNexis, and I was doing Kickstart one night a week.
Wow.
It was great, because I learned so much, and I think with work, you only know what you want to do when you do what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
I did not want to do law. I did not want to do the hedge fund scene. I didn't enjoy LexisNexis, but I really liked Kickstart, and so I found my job. And how did that happen? Well, our founder, Anthony Rose, who is probably one of the coolest and smartest people I've ever met in my life, was giving a presentation for Kickstart about Seed Legals, which is a legal tech platform which automates basically what I would have been doing in my job. And essentially, in listening to that conversation, I was like, that's not possible. That's not a thing. And not knowing who he was, right, and having the ego that I did, I messaged him on LinkedIn and I said, hi, like, I love your idea. I'd like to meet. So I meet Anthony, and he was nice enough to get back to me, and I meet him the next week, and I have this list of questions of what if this, what if that, what the liabilities, like, how can you, like, not have a legal person creating it, like, what if something goes wrong? And I sat there and he answered all these questions. And then at the end, he kind of looks at me and he goes, so what do you want? And I was like, I don't know. What do you want? What question is this? And he's like, no, seriously, what do you want? And I was like, I don't know. I was interested, because I was, right? It was a fluke. Kickstart was a fluke. That conversation was a fluke. And then he was like, well, I think, you know, you could potentially work for us. And then, you know, so on and so forth, started 6 months of conversations where I was joining this legal tech platform and I didn't really understand what they did. Like, I had a notion, but I didn't really get it. And I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I pitched at an event, and I was pitching for Stepforce, and Anthony was there, and he said, you know what, like, I think you're really good at this, I think you should do it. And so he gave me this title of ecosystem manager, and I was like, what the hell is that? I've never heard that in my life, right? Because you hear lawyer, banker, strategist, analyst, and then ecosystem manager. My parents asked me, and they were like, so what do you do? And I was like, honestly, I'm not too sure. And they were like, do you work? And I was like, I don't know. But the thing is, like, I think having a CEO who's so experienced, he picked up on stuff that I was good at that I didn't even know I was good at. And so I started, and very quickly I was like, hey, like, I actually really like meeting founders. I like teaching workshops. Like, I like spreading the knowledge. I also believe in Seed Legals as a company, in democratizing and allowing startups to raise money without paying 20% of that to their lawyers, right? We've cut cost and time of raising investment by 80%. Like, I believe, and it allowed me to stay close to a degree that I really liked, which was law. I didn't want to practice it because of the nature of legal firms, but I love the concept of law and what it can do. And so, you know, 6 months down the line, here we are, and I'm, cool. in a team that started at 20 when I joined, and now we're almost 50. We're, you know, doubling, we smashed our targets. I'm meeting incredible people. And I have to say, like, all of this came because I did a program that I didn't want to do and I took as a joke. And it ended up giving me a job that had nothing to do with the degree that I took. So I would say, like, to anybody listening, then this is coming from, like, a very, very corporate person. Take all the opportunities you can get, because you can make your own luck, right, by working hard, 100%. Like, it's not just going to come to you. But you don't really choose where that luck takes you.
Very true. Yeah. Fascinating story. Now, for someone who wants to gain experience in the startup world, like, one of the biggest excuses is, well, I don't know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell them?
I would say that's kind of like the really tough question, because I think the beauty of law firms and consultancies is it's safe. Like, it's predictable. You know what you're getting yourself into. It's more like, at least I know, you know, and I know where I'll be in a year if I do get it. And I think startups are a lot more like, it's about the fit. So AngelList is really good. UK startup jobs, like, there's a lot of kind of centralized places. Again, they're not great. My honest best opinion is, if you're actually interested in the startup world and you also just want a good night out, to be honest, is, again, like, it's always this thing of coming to London, but come to London and go to a demo day. Go watch the companies that are pitching, because they're pitching, meaning they're going to raise investment, meaning they're going to start hiring. And if you see one that you're like, wow, like, I really like what they're doing, then great. That's kind of the best way. I think researching on Google, like, top startups to work for doesn't really work.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah.
I think listening to all of the startup podcasts is a really good way to get exposure. I think if you go on any VC website and look at their portfolios, who have they recently invested in, that's a great way to see, oh, like, that company's just raised money and with a VC, aka they have good money. I like what they do. Just drop them an email. Drop them a LinkedIn message. I think those are really good ways of, you know, that's the also the big problem is, like, there's no like application centralized database for startups like there is for corporates, and that's also the thing that's really difficult. So those are kind of the top tips I would have. So just Eventbrite, type in accelerator, type in demo day, go. Like, it might seem daunting, but, you know, it's so cool. Like, you get to go to WeWork rooftop level places, you don't pay for anything, and you get free food and drink, and it's a fantastic time. So yeah.
How would I approach a VC, or so you said go into a VC, top 10 VCs, and then you see their portfolios and you really like a company. How do you approach the founder? How would I do that?
Literally, I think LinkedIn is super easy. Get their email, pester them. Like, it's so, when you're a founder, you have so much going on. Yeah. You should just keep, like, you got nothing to lose, to be honest. And all I know is that, like, of the people we've hired recently, all of them came randomly just reaching out to us and through recommendations from people. Yeah, we believe in recruitment systems, but, like, actually a lot of top hires, including myself, were so random just because I took the initiative to meet Anthony. I wouldn't have got this job otherwise, because I would never have known about Seed Legals.
Yeah.
So that was luck, you know? And so, yeah.
So let me rewind back to this quote that you said. You said startups initially were beneath you. Why was that?
I think when I'd worked in my second year of uni in a startup, it was really one of those shit startups. Like, there just wasn't goals and they weren't moving quickly, and it wasn't, you know, a lot of stupid people also work for startups and think they're really cool. And also the pay is, I think, a big thing, and also the fact that you don't get training, right? You don't have that. But with Seed Legals, God, I've learned so much more, because I literally was thrown into the deep end, into actually a very, very well-functioning company that is effectively disrupting the market. So I think I didn't know how difficult it could be working for a startup. And that's also why I thought it was beneath me, because I was like, the work is stupid. But the only reason I thought that was because I hadn't done what I wanted to do, and I'd never been in a proper startup. But when you're in a proper startup, it's insanely cool, because when you're moving that quickly, there is no bureaucracy.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, guys, this is an issue. Customers come to us saying, this clause is not in your contract. Within an hour, Anthony has coded it in, right? Whereas if you try to do that anywhere else, you want to make an amendment to a contract, like, that, this stuff kind of takes months.
Yeah.
And so I think the beauty of a startup is, like, you can see the product of your work instantaneously, and you're in control of the work that you do, and you create value. And it's really, really gratifying to be like, fuck, like, I'm 21 and I did that, and people are using it.
Nice.
So yeah, that's why, like, my opinion changed. And I think that's because universities like Warwick and LSE don't actually paint a good picture of what entrepreneurialism is.
I really, really like what you said. And one of the other things is, in terms of, like, this whole startup, like, you're working for Seed Legals, where do you see yourself, say, 10 years from now? And how will Seed Legal actually enable you to get where you want to get?
So that's a great question. I had my appraisal recently. I was asked the same thing. And honestly, I have no idea. I think, you know what, being really, really honest, it's so amazing working for a company like this. But one thing is that you do a lot. You do a lot of everything. And you don't hone in on a lot. So I think one thing I've definitely noticed is I lack a lot of hard skills. So for example, a lot of what I do is customer acquisition, right? Mm-hmm. Meeting people and being like, we're amazing, come join. And then I just assume they've all joined, and I've not actually tracked that through data or mechanisms. Okay. So I think the next step for me is, like, learning the infrastructure of how do you input metrics? How do you track the value that you're meant to be creating? And I guess just, you know, you never want to stagnate. Like, you always want to be developing your skill set. So I think at least for the next year now is just honing in on what I did in the last 6 months, developing myself professionally. So taking courses. I also want to learn how to code, not because I ever want to code, but more so I can understand when the development team messages me, we have to do this, that I actually understand what the hell they're talking about, because that's the language that they speak, right? So if you don't understand that, like, you can't really talk to them. I'll say, hey, can you do this thing? And they tell me no, and I don't get why, you know? And then 10 years from now, I don't know, like, I think an area that still really interests me is the VC spectrum. I think the sourcing of companies, of good companies, is very much a personal thing. And I think convincing those companies to come on to your VC is actually quite difficult, because there are so few really good companies. I'd love to learn more about the VC business model. I know that, especially after the whole SoftBank incident, people don't know if venture capital is a thing. But also bear in mind that, like, companies like Lazard are starting up venture capital branches, so it is a thing. So that might be a step. I might go into consulting. I wouldn't say I'm at a point where I could consult for a company yet. I need to learn a lot. I've also never really founded my own company that succeeded. So I guess there's a lot of avenues. I would like to stay within this sphere of disruption, mainly because companies we work with, I now have on my phone, right?
Nice.
I would never have known about them had I not worked with them, because Google sucks. Right? Because Google is based on ads. All these companies that are going to be huge in a few years, I'm already working with. And they love me because their customer acquisition at the moment is their focus. And so I like being part of that. I think when you get corporate, it gets a little bit, like, impersonal, and they don't really care about the customer anymore, and they don't have the passion for it, because it's all very, like, predictable. So I really like this sphere, and I kind of hope that I'm in it, in the whole startup scale-up industry. Yeah.
Forgive me if I'm probing, but what's the pay like?
So pay, I think when you're starting, you need to know that, like, you're never going to be starting within the, especially as a graduate, right, within the 40s or 50s of banking or law. That's not so true if you're a managerial person coming in, because one thing you should know about a company, starting a company, is you need to pay for top talent, simply. So if you're someone with experience and you grow the company very quickly, they pay for top talent, right? But if you're a graduate, you're probably within, the average benchmark is probably 24, 22 to 25. We're quite lucky at Seed Legals. It's above that because our company performs very well, and we're at the capacity where you can pay people more. Some companies give you options as a benefit instead of the full pay. So they'll give you maybe £22,000, but a stock option, which is quite nice. So I think you just have to be very realistic, but also when you're choosing that startup, like, look, like, they might fail, which sucks, but also be basically act as if you're an investor. Like, are you joining a startup that will do well? You know, what are they looking like? Because then, yeah, sure, you might start on a lower salary, or you could start on a lower salary and be one of the first 20 employees of a company that's going to be turning over, you know, 4 or 5 million in not that long.
But what are your metrics for judging whether a company's going to do well or not?
Traction. Okay. How many users do they have? Have they raised investment? What are their social media? Like, if they have no social media, right, like, nobody actually knows about them. And being in a startup is all about smoke and mirrors, right?
Yeah.
You have to look like you're everywhere, even if you're not.
Mm.
Who are the partners they're working with, right? That's a really good indication of are they good or not. What's the background of the founders? Have they successfully exited anything before? Or, like, what's their university degree like? Like, when you meet them, are you asking the right questions? Are they answering the right questions? I would definitely be skeptical of first-time founders, to be honest. Not because they're bad, but because, like, they're probably in a stage where they're learning all those mistakes and it's really unlikely. I think the best founders are very much like people who have exited before and they're on their second venture, scale-up type things.
Mm.
Like Anthony, you know, he's got 5 patents under his name and he successfully sold 3 businesses. So that's always a good tell. And I guess, though, like, it doesn't have to be a successful business. Like, it could also just be a great idea and you really like what you do. And then, you know, if they fail, well, hey, it's a lot of experience.
So it's... But then what? Okay, so there's this whole concept of not putting your eggs into one basket, right? So how does that play out here? If I don't want to spend all my time, say, working for just one startup, is it possible to work for multiple startups and then see how it works? Does that exist? Does part-time jobs exist?
It is probably possible. I mean, I've never done it myself. Like, I think a lot of startups do take on people part-time, especially when they don't have money. If you want to go in different sectors, that's quite important. Like, if you're not sure what sector you want to do, like, make sure you take 2 different companies. But you could work for a company for a year, right? And they could tank and you could realize you really don't like it, right? And then you come out of that year and you're still only 22.
Mm.
I think that's a big thing. Like, you're not dedicating the rest of your life to them. And thing is like, you will be working, or at least I will be working till I'm about 65, right? So when I'm looking back at 65, how much did those 6 months to 1 year affect my life? If you think about the fact that you're like, we've been thinking about jobs since we were maybe like 18, as in we got put into the work sphere like not very long ago. This is the first year that you will actually be in the work environment. What did you think was going to happen? And I think the more you do stuff like that, as long as it's not retarded and you're not wasting your life, like, the better, you more likely you are to do a job that you love and you're good at. And when you're good at something, that's actually when the real money starts coming in. As opposed to doing something you don't like that you can do, you're kind of capped a little bit.
Yeah. So the whole idea of working for someone instead of working on your own thing sometimes is like, there's this ego clash, and I fall victim to it quite often. Did you ever fall victim to it when you were like, okay, I'm doing Stepforce, and now someone's telling me to join their team, which is basically working for a company? Did you feel like you didn't want to do that because then it wouldn't be yours?
So actually, I'm kind of someone that I don't really want to be a founder. Like, I became one as a means to an end. I like having teams, I like having projects. I'm not actually great at creating my own goals, so I actually really like good leadership. I get frustrated if it's bad leadership and I'm smarter than whoever's above me. Luckily, that's not the case at Seed Legals. I think with people, like, the thing is, you know, to be very straight, like, you're 21, like, how much do you really know? And if you can't see past the fact that somebody else's failures could be to your benefit, then the way that you'll approach your business is probably not great.
But you see, that rhetoric is what people tell us even when it comes to consulting or banking. You don't know enough. That's why you get into the industry, learn, and then you can do your own thing.
Well, I mean, the thing is, a lot of people do is they go, they venture, they succeed or they fail, or they don't necessarily do either. They kind of succeed and they kind of fail, and it's kind of like a good business, but it didn't take off hugely.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, so that's what I didn't know. Because I think right now, if you look at it, you're like, okay, what do I not know? And it's really hard to say, like, what do you not know? Like, you haven't actually gone out and done it.
Yeah.
So I think a really good, like, I guess, pointer is actually doing it, seeing your pain points, and then building. And that doesn't necessarily mean, like, going and working for someone else, and it could also mean just professional development. Like, what skills was I lacking?
Yeah.
What practical skills do I need? Whether that's marketing, whether that's product development, whether that's coding. Or it's like, hey, like, actually, I don't actually understand the sector. I thought I did, but I didn't. And it's like going into companies that have the data that you want to know about. It becomes different because you start doing the job for yourself, right? For your own learning capacity, as opposed to just working for someone and seeing what you learn.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really cool thing about being a failed founder, is you're like, oh, that's exactly what I want to learn. This job is going to allow me to learn that, and then I'm going to leave. That's fine. So that's like quite a nice approach, because you're not doing it for them. Like, you're doing it for yourself and for the access to the data that you wouldn't otherwise have.
But do you feel like you probably would be trapped in this cycle where it's like, hey, I'm learning, I'm getting the money, the company's doing well, but now I want to start my own thing. I've got this really cool idea. And then the whole idea of just, will I be able to fund myself? How will I do it from startup, like ground up? Would that play a role in just making you a little more scared of venturing out on your own?
You know, that's always the big question. Like, you know, you get people leaving consultancy firms or whatever to do their own thing. It really isn't a given. It's going to be tough. Like, you're suddenly from money to no money.
But yeah, exactly.
It's pretty straightforward. Like, I personally would like savings. Like, I'm quite a careful person. But if you're someone that can live really frugally, then hey, like, why not? And at worst, like, let's say you do fail, you're out of money. Like, people don't stop hiring.
Yeah,
right, true. People hire every year. Like, the worst that's gonna happen is you get a job. So
yeah, I like that one. So wrapping this up, I just want to know, how did you manage, what were your best management techniques for actually running a company and also doing a top class degree, which would, I'm sure, would be quite demanding from LSE? How did you manage it?
Honestly, like, with the management of Stepforce, that was fully down to the people around me, holding me accountable. It's a really silly thing to say, but basically, like, one night, one of my co-founders just called me and was like, you need to get your shit together. Like, you had these deadlines, like, 2 days ago. Like, we're all counting on you. And I was like, shit, I've got to do this. And so I did, right? And it's that thing of, like, that's why it's really important to like your co-founders and believe in them, because if it's someone that you think slacks, you're just not going to care if they say that. But because I really valued the respect of my co-founders and I felt guilty, I did the work, kind of thing. And they were, and it's a give and take. It's like any marriage, like, you're gonna give what you get, right? So that was that, like, a big thing there was very much just, you know, having them on my back and also enjoying going to Kickstart and learning.
Yeah.
With my degree, I very much took the opposite approach, which was checking what exams had come up in the past years, checking the probability that my question would come up, and then learning the basic amount I needed to, because I didn't love my degree. So I took a very minimalist, efficient approach. Bear in mind, considering I was doing 4 different projects and studying law, that was the year I got my best results. I ended up having 2 firsts, 1 in tax law and 1 in my dissertation, a 2, very high 2-1, and then a 2-2 in philosophy. That doesn't really count. Point being is, like, I was shocked by my results.
Wait, so how did you manage your academics? How did you frugally manage it?
Well, so they give you, 100 pages of reading for a topic?
Yeah.
About 10 of those matter, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're in an exam and it's 45 minutes per paper, how much exactly can you write in that time?
Fair enough.
Right?
Yeah.
You can't write 10 pages worth of... So it was about, like, knowing, okay, so they want me to address this law and they want me to write 2 sentences on it, and then they want me to drop in the name of a guy. So that's what I did. So that was, like, something that could guarantee me, like, a 2-1. It was basically structure and memory. I was very lucky to get first in the one that I did, because I really don't know how that happened, to be honest. But point being is, like, I knew that all I needed was a 2-1, and because I wasn't going to go into academic law, I didn't need more than that.
Yeah.
I also didn't know how to get that. So it was very much like, yeah, like, there's loads and loads and loads of reading. What is the point? And you generally can know the point of the reading pretty quickly, and that's the only point that's going to matter in your essay.
Yeah.
Rather than discussing how the opinion was created, you just need to know the opinion of that person.
Fair enough. Just wrapping it up, do you have any other thoughts, any other comments that you'd like to give our listeners who are student entrepreneurs, just like you were not too long ago?
I would say, in the whole process, I think things get a lot easier when you actually start working. like when you start working, it's so much easier to actually go on from there, whether it's you're working as a founder, you're working for a business, because you suddenly know loads of other people that are working that are basically your connections into wherever you want to go. So don't really stress too much about what your first job is, because that's the hardest bit done. Once you're in that first job, it's so much easier to go anywhere else. Mm. It just is. One, because your friends are doing it. Two, because you know just through work connections. Three, because you've done a job. You're going into an interview actually having experience having done a job.
Yeah.
And four, because it allows you to say, hey, like, what am I actually good at? Or what am I not good at? So I would definitely say, like, don't stress that this first decision is, like, going to determine the rest of your life. That's the whole thing. Like, it's your first decision in the professional world. It's certainly not going to define the rest of your life. Maybe the one that you make when you're about 35 will, but yeah. Other than that, yeah. Not so
hopefully
much.
By then you have enough experience to figure
exactly.
it out. But if people start like changing jobs very quickly, is it like a bad thing? Is it a wrong impression in the recruiter's mind?
I mean, we live in an instantaneous society. It's so rare for people to join a company nowadays and stay for 20 years. It just doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Like, we literally live instantaneously. And I think the job market looks at that. I think the one thing I will say is, like, if you keep jumping about every 6 months, they probably won't hire you just because they don't want to train you and you leave. If you're someone that stays for like 1 or 2 years, 2.5, 3, like, that's quite nice, because it's like, okay, like, that's a long enough time for us to be like, okay, that's actually fine, where 6 months is a really short amount of time. If you hate something, leave, but don't just try, I need to get as much experience as possible and I'm gonna move around. Like, that's actually to your detriment a little bit.
All right, Isabel, that was great. I promise you, this is just the last thing. We do this with all our guests on our podcast. It's a rapid fire round, so you can't think. You just have to speak. What's the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning?
Look at my phone.
Okay, what's the last thing you do?
Look at my phone.
What's your favorite podcast?
The Journal by the Wall Street Journal. It's fantastic.
What do you like about it?
It's just so well researched. Okay. It's straight to the point.
Okay. Your favorite song at the moment?
Muramasa, Complicated.
And favorite artist?
Elton John at the moment.
Nice. Favorite movie?
I don't know. My Gran Torino.
And your favorite book?
Oh, great book is A Little Life. Just a great book. Or if you want something kind of more interesting, How to Make Friends and Influence People is very good. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much, Isabella. It has been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much
for coming on this podcast.
No worries.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to our podcast. If you liked it, do give us a like and leave a review on wherever you hear these podcasts. And for weekly content, subscribe to our podcast channel and check us out on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. See you soon.